This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments Update for the week of September the 2nd, 2014. This update is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated along with your State Society of CPAs. Any use of this audio recording or the materials with this podcast without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. This broad podcast is copyright 2014 Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated. We're going to go ahead and take a look at what's happened in the past week with regard to federal tax developments. And we're going to take a look at a few developments that took place over this week. There was a little more activity this week than last week. We had at least a few court cases and a significant clarification on an issue related to the statute of limitations. But we're going to start out with a warning the IRS gave this week to all taxpayers in News Release 2014-84. This is a warning the IRS has posted regarding the fact that a number of individuals out there are posing as IRS employees making phone calls to taxpayers. And these scams have been coming at an increasing rate. These individuals will call your clients, and they will claim to be IRS agents, indicating that perhaps A, they need to give them information because there's an IRS refund and they're not able to get that information to them. They may call and tell the individual that there is a problem with the return, and if they do not take action immediately, that there's somebody coming to arrest them. There's all kinds of things, or to seize assets, or to do various other things. The goal of these calls is generally to obtain personal information from the individuals before they have time to think. That's the general rule for scams. What makes these particularly insidious, though, is that these people are going to call and they have a lot of personal information about the taxpayer in question. What people don't realize, and this is where the issues come up, is that it's not all that difficult to obtain that information from various sources, and the fact that it's on the phone convinces people, especially people who are older, that it must be the IRS legitimately, because obviously all these scams are on computers. And while they may be, to be honest, they're using the computer systems to obtain the information, they're calling on the phone. The issues that are regarded. The IRS in this news release published a list of what they call as the telltale signs of a scam. And what they say is here are a few things that taxpayers need to be aware of is the sign of a scam. You get a call about taxes that you owe without first receiving a notice in the mail from the IRS. The IRS always sends a notice first via mail. They demand that you pay the taxes in question without giving the taxpayer the opportunity to question or appeal the tax that they say you owe. That's an automatic telltale sign of a scam. They require you to use a specific payment method to pay your taxes, such as a prepaid debit card. Yes, actually they do use things like that, and people go ahead and buy for it. They ask for credit or debit card numbers over the phone, or they threaten to bring in local police or other law enforcement groups to have you arrested for not paying. As all of us would be aware, the IRS would not bring in local law enforcement individuals. They really wouldn't bring in the FBI or any of those people. Basically, they have their own CID division. You know, they're able to deal with their own issues in this regard. So all of those are things that people need to understand are a key indicator that what you have here is a fraud. The IRS also suggests if you get a phone call from somebody claiming to be with the IRS, what you should do is verify by calling the IRS at the 1-800-829-1040 number. And the people on that line, in essence, if there truly is an IRS assessment outstanding or there truly is a balance of tax due, they're going to be able to look in the records and discover that. However, they won't have any of the records of the people on the phone. And regular IRS employees should allow you to basically hang up and recall. Now, notice, if you do that, don't recall the number the person on the phone tells you to recall. Recall the number that is you obtain independently. CPAs should consider telling their clients about these particular scams because they are increasing, and they need to indicate that if they do receive any contacts from the IRS, they should direct them back to you as their CPA. Secondly, they should also be aware that these same type of scams occur for people posing as their bank or their brokerage firm. So they need to be aware whenever they get a call like this, they should be very, very leery of phone calls asking for any sort of information because of the increasing number of phone call scams that are taking place these days. Let's continue on now to a case from the bankruptcy court. Actually, this was a case came from the bankruptcy court, but this week went through the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. This is the case of In re Vaughn. It is a Chapter 11 bankruptcy case. The citation here is 114 AFTR 2nd 2014-5191. And this is a case of a taxpayer who is trying to file bankruptcy, is looking for discharge of taxes, but who had purchased a marketed tax shelter from an international accounting firm. Now, the gentleman in question was going to basically sustain a fairly significant gain on the sale of his business. So he had a business sale, and he was going to sustain a gain that was in the eight-figure range. So he went out and bought what was called a blips transaction. The transaction generated on it by its own terms a purported tax loss of $42 million. However, he reported less than $42 million due to, at least per his deposition, being told by a CPA with the international accounting firm that he probably should report less than the actual loss shown from the transaction because that would lower the chances of him being pulled in for exam. Okay, that became an issue. Now, at trial, he denied that had been told to him, but of course, obviously, there is this little problem with, why'd you say at deposition this was here? He also admitted both times, though, that he knew he did not have an economic loss of $42 million, $33 million, or any of the claim numbers, that there was no true economic loss, aside from the $506,000 fee that he had paid for entering into this transaction. But he claimed the loss on his return anyway. The IRS, this was his 1999 return. In September of 2000, the IRS issued Notice 2044. And in February of 2001, the international accounting firm gave him a copy of that notice, and also recommended that because eventually as people came under exam, and they came under exam in this area, and he knew, by the way, that one of his business associates who had also purchased this particular shelter was under exam, they suggested he enter a voluntary program. Now, about the time he discovered these problems, he got divorced, and he turned around and within a few months was remarried to a new person. This person that he remarried, he bought her a house. He bought a car. He put $1.5 million into a trust for her daughter. Okay. Now, eventually, in a few months, he also basically, in a couple of years, he divorced her, but not after going on a bit of a spending spree. And in the divorce, essentially, she got a number of the assets. Now, as time went on, he eventually discovered that the person he was married to when he claimed the shelter loss filed for his spouse relief, he filed an objection on that point. Now we move forward to his Chapter 11 case. He's trying to get a discharge of this assessment of taxes in bankruptcy. The bankruptcy court, the U.S. District Court, and the Tenth Circuit denied him. Under a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you're not allowed to have a discharge of taxes for any taxes that related to either a fraudulent return or a willful intent to evade tax. The bankruptcy court found that this was both, and we concentrate most heavily on the willful intent to evade tax side of the equation when we get into the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said you knew you were a business person who was sophisticated. You knew there was not a real economic loss. You also knew in 2001, before you went and spent all this money and did everything else that was involved with your new spouse, you knew that the IRS was likely to examine the shelter, and if they did, you also knew from how it had been marketed to you that there was a really significant decrease in your tax liability for 2000 by claiming this, and that if the IRS came back on you, that you would owe the tax, the interest, the penalties. Despite that, you went on the spending spree, including putting $1.5 million into trust for the daughter of your new spouse. You spent tons of money. You basically depleted your estate. The court found that the knowledge of the fact that the shelter was iffy, and the knowledge of the fact and the fact that you went and on a spending spree despite knowing that there likely was going to be a huge tax assessment means that that was a willful evasion of tax, and that meant no discharge is available in a Chapter 11 case. Now we continue on to the next case here. This is Bunch versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-177. And despite the fact that this sounds like something that should be from a 2008 return, this is really going back to 2000-2001. In this case, this gentleman went out and paid over $4 million for an investment in mortgage loans that claimed to be paying 20%. Well, regardless of how we looked at that in 2000, by 2001, it was clear that a number of these mortgages were essentially going into default that were held by the promoter. The promoter had packaged these up and sold these as package deals. So these package of loans, a number of them were in default. However, the promoter never told the buyers that it was in default. And in fact, the individual kept receiving interest payments right up until March 31st of 2006. In the middle of April of 2006, the entity filed for bankruptcy protection. It still claimed it had assets at least equal to its liabilities. Well, it turned out that that was, shall we say, somewhat in error. And by 2009, the promoter had pled guilty to charges related from or arising from this particular transaction. Now, the problem in this case became Mr. and Mrs. Bunch claimed a loss for the over $4 million mortgage loan investments in 2006. On the original return, they claimed it as a bad debt deduction. And on an amended return after the 2009 conviction of the promoter, they changed that over to a theft loss. The tax court denied either method of trying to claim a deduction in 2006. The problem was not that there was no economic loss. Clearly, the Bunches had put $4 million into something that was not going to be worth anywhere near $4 million. And clearly, there appears to be some bad faith on the part of the promoter. But the problem is you can only deduct either of these in 2006 if you could show 2006 was the year that either the bad debt or the theft occurred. The court found that this was not a non-business bad debt, or was not, I should say, a business bad debt, so it's a non-business. Therefore, you had to show it was fully worthless. They had filed a claim for, they filed a claim in the bankruptcy in 2006. Also, in 2006, at least as much as they knew by the end of the year, there still may have been very substantial assets that would be available to get them repaid, so it was not clear they would receive even less than the face value by the end of 2006. And in reality, in 2009, they did eventually receive a very small partial distribution. To be a bad debt, non-business bad debt, it must be wholly worthless. They found there was no evidence of it being wholly worthless in 2006, and that in fact their filing in the bankruptcy court suggested they were pursuing collection. Same basic problem would occur with theft. Now, theft has a second problem. You've got to show it's a real theft under state law. The court said they didn't feel that they had shown that by the end of 2006 that that information was available to them. But number two, they said, even if we grant that you could prove a theft, you couldn't prove that there was no reasonable prospect of recovering any of the amount that was stolen at the end of 2006. Again, the same problem. They filed in the bankruptcy court and eventually received a partial distribution. Therefore, no loss is allowed in 2006. Losses in either case will only be allowed once there is no further prospect of recovery in either of these cases. Note that these cases predate the rulings that we had when we talked about the issue there for our nice friend Bernie, who basically, as you may remember, essentially ran away with a few billion dollars out of New York. In that particular case, when we look at that background, those rulings did not come down till later. This case didn't come under those rulings. It comes rather under the 2006 rules, so the Madoff rulings do not help them in this case. In Private Letter Ruling 2014-34-022, the IRS effectively ruled when an organization was requesting status as a 501c7 private, basically social club. The IRS ruled that it could not have that because of minimal face-to-face meetings. In essence, the IRS effectively ruled you cannot have a virtual social club. You can't be a virtual 501c7 organization. The ruling held that face-to-face meetings are basically a requirement. The fact that this organization only held one event a year with a face-to-face meeting and everything else, 99% of what it did was done virtually over the internet, it could not qualify for that. Where this may be concerning would be an organization that was today a social club, but eventually started moving to a more virtual organization. You may find that that may put your social club tax-exempt status at risk by moving away from that. We also have the case now of Swigert versus Commissioner. This is a case of the IRS simply being stubborn. And there was an award of attorney's fees in this case when the IRS did this. The IRS had issued a math error notice in this case. Now, when the IRS issues a notice based on math error, this one was head of household filing status and he failed to list the name of the child. A taxpayer, when they receive a math error adjustment, as long as they request within 60 days that the assessment be abated, the IRS is required to do that and then go back through the standard deficiency provisions that would allow the taxpayer the 30-day have to issue. They'd have to go through the whole examining process, issue a 30-day letter, allow the people to go to appeals, and do that whole process. In this case, the problem was the computer kicked the notice out 16 days later. The computer went on autopilot, issued its final notice of intent to levy. The taxpayers protested this and continued to do so. The IRS refused to basically abate the math error notice until the taxpayer could prove that he was basically allowed to be head of household status. The problem is Section 6213 requires the service to abate in that case and then reopen the situation under the standard deficiency provision. The IRS failing to do that, Mr. Swigert was awarded basically fees. One problem he had, though, was he got fees for the legal case. He got very little in administrative fees because, as you'll note when you read the case, the court found that because the IRS kept it out of the regular basically assessment routine, the standard routine under 6213, the problem was that we never got to a trigger that would have allowed for an award of administrative fees until very, very, very late in the process. Finally, we have the case of Barkett versus Commissioner, and this is interesting, 143 TC number 6, because this one is explaining how to apply the home concrete decision going forward. In this case, the taxpayer failed to report earned income. The taxpayer had a bunch of earned income. They had failed to report that earned income on their return. Now, in addition, they had sold a number of investment assets. Their net gains were relatively smaller, but they had sold $7 million worth of investment assets. You may remember from the home concrete decision. That was where the IRS, where the Supreme Court held that the IRS could not open up a six-year statute due to overstatement of basis. This is the case where the taxpayer was, again, we're past the three-year statute, we're into the six-year statute. Was there a 25% omission from gross income? The taxpayer said, well, you know, you've got to count that $7 million as my gross income. The taxpayer is claiming that, and if you do that, their omission, while it was six figures, was going to be far less than 25% if gross income was in the seven-figure range. However, if instead of that being gross income, the net gain was gross income, then this adjustment is well within the 25% understatement and the IRS could move forward with the assessment. The tax court said you misunderstood the home concrete decision. Home concrete was determining if an understatement of basis or an overstatement of basis was an omission from gross income. And the court found the Supreme Court, in line with the Colony decision and in line with the tax court's own rulings prior to the Supreme Court's decision in home concrete, had held that there was no omission in that case. However, as the court pointed out, in this case, everybody agrees this earned income was omitted. And once we have an omission, how do you calculate gross income for purposes of 25%? The court points out that basically Section 61 includes in gross income net gains from the sale of assets. It says once we have an omission, which we do, you do not take the gross selling price for computing 25%. You rather take the net gain. This clarification is important because it's very easy. I think a lot of people read home concrete to suggest that $7 million number would be your measuring number. Certainly, that was a position taken by the taxpayer in this case. The tax court has made it clear that they had not taken that position in the past. They do not take that position. They basically had held the same as the Supreme Court, but they said our holding is limited to omission. In this case, because we weren't talking about overstating basis, it's clear the amounts in question were omitted. The IRS was not aware of these. And because they were omitted, now we go back and figure out our 25%. That is based by consulting only net gain. This concludes the Current Federal Tax Developments podcast for this week. Be sure to tune in next week and listen to us when we talk about the developments for the coming week.